This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. We're headed to Washington. Washington's point of view, I mentioned that while we're talking, there are updates all the time coming from the Middle East. Right now, the Israeli media, Times of Israel, is reporting 250 dead. The Wall Street Journal is reporting 300 Israelis dead. 250 Israelis dead, according to the Times of Israel. 300 Israelis dead, according to the Wall Street Journal. Many captured. We don't have a definitive number of how many are being held by the Palestinian actors, the Hamas and their agents. The Islamic Jihad is one of their agents, and they're making bold statements in Beirut. And in the middle of the night, this war promises to get much, much worse. However, we're focusing on Ukraine, which is all right now in the midst of a firefight trying to break through before the weather changes to the lines of defense that Russia's erected to keep Ukraine from breaking through to the Sea of Azov. Washington is now in the midst of turmoil because of Congress no longer having a speaker. Before, the speaker was defense-rated. What we have is the Congress refusing additional aid to Ukraine. Now, that money, $24 billion, is mentioned. That was to replenish the U.S. arsenal that has been or is on the way to Ukraine. Therefore, I mentioned the U.S. arsenal is not now at 100%. The manufacturing power of the United States has been distracted these many years and is not now capable of generating the equipment we need in time we need for one war, let alone two wars. So Congress is withholding money from the U.S. to replenish its arsenal. At the same time, the Israeli arsenal is not bottomless, and the president's statement indicates that we support Israel. So if they request arms and equipment, I imagine it will be something that is vouchsafed by the Biden administration. In other words, Washington is now having to deal with the fact that the money is not endless, the weapons are not endless, and we've got two commitments, and one of them has the Congress reluctant. Washington's point of view, Professor.
Well, first, I think that you're quite right that the government is, the American policy is now really impaled on domestic issues, because the issue in the Congress with the Republicans is very much a function of domestic politics. And it's also a function of the failure of the Biden administration to ever to make the case for the Ukraine war. Recall that by year four of World War II, by the final time that Roosevelt ran for re-election, his fourth term, he did very, very badly compared to how he'd done previously. And that was because people were fed up that the war wasn't over yet. If you look at Ukraine, we're upset, but my goodness, it isn't even 2 years. 2 years after the, or 2 years after the beginning of World War One, we were in 1916, which was the year of stalemate. This was the year of paralysis. This was the year at which the Western Front seemed to have become stagnant. That is to say, there was no strategic gain, but there was no end to horrendous casualties. So the impatience with Ukraine, which is what's going on here, is partly a function of just the difficulty of winning the Ukraine war after the Russians have invaded, but it's also a function of the fact that our administration and our military have not been realistic about, they've not been unflinching in recognizing, they have failed to recognize that the only way to end this war is by facilitating a Ukrainian victory and then making a peace which will survive. It's not a peace which has to have walls and occupation troops or America, whatever. We want a clean peace that does not have to be constantly tuned up. So if we look at Washington now, we have the most, I would say, the most incapable administration in American history. It's at least it's worse than the Wilson administration after October 2nd, 1919, which is the day that President Wilson had the stroke that paralyzed his left, almost destroyed eyesight in his right eye, and also changed his moods and all the rest. And who he had his wife, he had his physician, Dr. Grayson, and he had, I guess, Tumulty and a few other people who essentially kept him cocooned. But in 1919, 1920, there were not international issues and issues of peace and war of the gravity that we face today. So the failure of American leadership. Now, the necessity for American leadership is to some extent something that we have created by our policies and our willingness to assume obligations that we should not have assumed or that we should have shared. But right now, the United States is the linchpin. It's the keystone. It's the most important source of ideas, guidance, money, all the rest in the whole international order, which is to say the maintenance, at a minimum, the maintenance of international peace and the avoidance of catastrophic war. And as you've hinted at, and I will say, we're AWOL. We're simply not doing the role that is required by the world that we have helped to create since the end of World War II. And in the past, the mistakes have seemed to be not that serious. Even Afghanistan, which was just a disaster, was over so quickly that in America it wasn't noticed much, although the rest of the world drew in their breath and said, is this how hopeless and hapless and criminally negligent the Americans are? And the answer was yes. And this then gave heart to all the the bad guys, basically. So until we have some kind of rational government process, until we have some kind of ability of the parties to work together on areas of national interest, and we don't have the kind of extraordinary, overweening ambition that we see on the left, which is leading them to politicize both the FBI, the Secret Service, the CIA, the whole judicial structure. It's just breathtaking to me how little they are concerned by the erosion of civil liberties. And on the other side of the aisle, there's an equally unrealistic set of assumptions about the future of the country. Although they're not as destructive right now, they could be very destructive later. We have to somehow achieve a consensus about what our country is all about and what we do. And unfortunately, we're in a situation where the policies that are being advanced are not the policies being advanced are not conducive to maintaining the country that requires them to the existence of which, let's put it this way, that the functioning of the United States depends on a high degree of legal rights and guarantees and immunities so that nobody will be afraid or be oppressed by the central government and so forth. Yet at the same time, the policies that are being advanced undermine that. So groups become defensive and they become sort of nihilistic. They become inclined to violence. In other words, the needs of the country are being undermined by the politics of the country. And this is very, very bad. It's happened before in the Civil War, but it's happening now. And I'm just not sure how this is going to resolve itself.
Professor, a quick question, a minute or so.
Sure.
In my father's generation and your father's generation, we had a group called the America Firsters. Now, on the day after Pearl Harbor, they faded into the woodwork. There are moments in these last months where the American Firsters look to be reborn without particular sense of irony. Sometimes it's called isolationism and associated with the Republican Party. But American Firsters were more than that. They were adamantly anti-European. They were anti any intervention whatsoever anywhere in Europe. Let them all eat cake. That was the American Firsters. And they were militant. And they were not unsympathetic to the Bund, which was a vital organization in the eastern part of the United States for the years before the war, before Germany declared war on the U.S. Are the America Firsters or the isolationists, I don't know what to call them, the dissenters, are they aware of their patrimony?
Well, of course, John Quincy Adams said we do not go abroad in search of monsters to slay. I think that the impulse of the America Firsters is actually quite understandable given the nature of the country, as were the political ecology, the economic ecology. Our economy grew driven by American demand and insulated from the rest of the world by high tariffs, that we had the resources that we needed. And in many ways, it was a tremendous job to get us into either World War I or World War II. And there is a very vocal set of people who argue that both of these, or one or both of these, were mistakes. The liberals who dominated American political, or they were very, very important in American political discussion until Vietnam, have now evaporated. And they have, the successors of the liberals are, in a sense, the predecessors of the liberals. That is, the liberals come out of left-wing socialist and communist ideology. That's one of the sources. There is, of course, a very strong tradition of English liberalism. I'm not saying that these are simply the offspring of the left, but the existence of the liberal movement and its intellectual hegemony in the United States for a long time prevented the government of the United States from tilting dramatically to the isolationist side, which would have meant an America which essentially had a Canadian foreign policy, something like what the Canadian foreign policy has been until recently, when the Canadians have suddenly gotten worried. But it was one that sort of we have plenty of land and we don't have to do anything and no one wants to get us. So I think that the political configuration of our domestic politics now makes it very difficult to deal with the America First instinct, which is in many ways a very laudable instinct, but it's not to be taken at full strength. The strength at which we should take it is we share burdens. We are parts of alliances in which all the people, all the members of the alliance are working hard. We don't have to be in charge. We value lots of discussion. And we Americans are not willing to sign blank checks. What the president, Biden, has just said about Israel, I think politically he has to say this. But as someone who is very concerned that both the Israelis and the Muslims in that part of the world have peaceful lives and don't obliterate each other, I have to say that since that those two sides are incapable of making peace, we have to be involved to force them to make a peace. Now, none of the European powers or the United States has really said anything about the fact that Israel has failed to make peace now in the wake of two wars, 67 and 73. They could have made peace. It would have been very, very difficult, but better than now. And if we become overcommitted, notice that all of the Muslim countries, the whole Middle East, the Saudis, who are about to normalize with Israel, that's all going to change. The analog to our isolationism, in a way, is a kind of Islamic third culture, third block approach, which has been you know, ever since the Egyptians and whatnot, they've tried to form Islamic confederations. After World War One, we would have had an Arab state had it not been for the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the French insistence that they had to have their place in the Middle East. What we're seeing now is a potential and disastrous polarization between two parts of the world that don't really get along very well anyway, namely the Islamic world and the European, the sort of European American world. So this is all, it's very, very worrying. And I think the lack of American leadership, the failure, I mean, Roosevelt had a vision. It was all wrong. Within 6 months of his death in April 1945, you had, it was clear that the whole post-war period was going to be dealing with the Soviet Union, something that Roosevelt had never even considered. But at least he had a vision. Right now, we just have a blur, and we have opportunism, and this is on both sides, and we have talk which is empty. It's empty talk. We don't have, as you pointed out, our military, I mean, half of our submarines are basically in the shop. If you look at the ability of our military to do things, it's terrifying. Yet we're not, our Defense Department is not focusing on these things. We, as one person I know who's a young officer in the Army says, we have to be lethal. We have to be lethal. That's what the Army is for. It's about breaking things and killing people. And we don't ever want to do either of those things, but sometimes it's necessary to be able to do it and to do it efficiently and effectively and at the minimum cost to all involved. We're not even aiming for that. So I feel that the lack of American leadership, to some extent the creation of the overextension and the willing embrace of an exaggerated leadership role, is now the single biggest problem for the rest of the world.
Professor H.A. Mackinder, International Relations, commenting on Six Capital, Six Points of View. The most difficult of all is Beijing, not involved to our knowledge in the Middle East, but then again involved in the Middle East because of its relationship with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with buying oil from Iran and Saudi Arabia. So when we come back, just a few minutes with the professor's thoughts about Beijing's point of view with a split-screen war in the Middle East and war in Europe. I'm John Batchelor.